The Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins. Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Mr. Chair, happy early Valentine's Day.
Representative, Representative Mueller.
How do you compete with that? Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Rowley.
Present and happy to be here.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Here.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill.
Caitlin, I think, if I can speak for just a minute, I think she told Carlos that she had two committee meetings at the same time and she would be a little bit late.
That's correct. Thank you, Representative Poston.
Thank you. That concludes roll call.
Thank you. Members, there is a quorum present. Representative Poston is correct and Representative O'Neill. In addition, this is a pretty hard day for all of us, but especially for Representative O'Neill. As you all know, one of our communities in our district, the community of Buffalo, suffered an incredible tragic event that cost the lives of a dear young Minnesotan and put a number of others in grave danger, including some others that were injured in a violent attack in their community. And so the chair's sincere thoughts and empathies for the good people of Buffalo. And I trust that I speak on behalf of all committee members in saying that. Members, this hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations in Response to the COVID-19 Infectious Disease Pandemic, requiring public health exercise of social distancing. The public can visit the Minnesota House website to view House Rule 10.01, as well as to visit our webpage, our committee webpage on that website to view information on how to access streaming video cast of this proceeding, as well as instructions on how to participate in public testimony. Members, we do have a bevy of minutes to adopt today, but the good news is that once we do that, we're up to speed on our minutes. So I do appreciate the patience of all committee members. And of course, once we adopt those, then we'll be able to post them up on our website so that the public can have transparent information of the proceedings, formal proceedings of this committee. So with that, if I can ask our Vice Chair, Representative Frazier, to move the minutes of January 21st, January 26th, February 4th, February 5th, and February 9th, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I will move all those minutes as for the date stated.
Very well. Representative Representative Frazier moves adoption of the minutes of January 21st, 26th, February 4th, 5th, and 9th. Any discussion? If not, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And the minutes of January 21st, 26th, February 4th, February 5th, and February 9th are hereby adopted. Members, today's agenda is a two-part agenda. We have two bills before us. We have House File 28, as well as House File 856. There are testifiers that have signed up to speak on these bills. Some members who have been here on the committee in the past will recall that we have heard and debated these bills and actually moved them forward at one point or another in the past. Nevertheless, I'm really looking forward to a good explanation and a good discussion among ourselves of the contents of these bills. So with that, I'm going to ask Representative Joaquin to come forward. And she will be presenting House File 28. And the chair will move House File 28 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Joaquin, welcome to the committee. You know the routine. I also think, I believe it's an author's amendment. I can move that whatever time you wish me to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing House File 28. And yes, there is a A1 amendment that has some a minor addition that the Elder Justice Center requested regarding the types of training offered. And I would very much appreciate if the chair would move that amendment.
Very well, members. House File 28 being before us, the chair moves the A1 amendment, which essentially puts the bill in the shape that the author wishes it to be before us today. Any discussion on that? Hearing none, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And House File 28, as amended, is before us. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Many of us bring forward bills that are born from experiences that we've had. For me, that is the case with this bill. My grandmother, who's now gone, had Alzheimer's the last few years of her life. At the time, she was a widow living alone in her home, and her children were sharing the tasks of helping her age in place. There was always a worry and a concern that my grandmother would get out of the house on her own somehow. She lived in North St. Paul, a block from Lake Phelan, and while the proximity of water was a concern, so was the Minnesota winter. If a vulnerable adult that has Alzheimer's or any other type of dementia does wander off, minutes could make a difference. In 2014, when I came to the legislature, this issue was at the top of my mind. I had heard of the silver alerts and crafted a bill to have a working group look at whether or not a silver alert would be effective in Minnesota. That bill passed, the working group met, and the bill before you is part of their recommendations. I would like to thank the Alzheimer's Association for being with me every step of the way on this very personal project. In Section 1, Subdivision 1, there's an appropriation from the General Fund to the Department of Public Safety for grants from the Office of Justice Programs and to make changes to the Crime Alert Network. Subdivision 2 are details on how the OJP would administer regional and statewide voluntary training grants to state and local law enforcement so that they can understand the population that they serve who has Alzheimer's or dementia. It is focused on law enforcement agencies that have less than 45 peace officers. There has been a reporting requirement as well. In Subdivision 3, there are details of the appropriation to the Minnesota Criminal Alert Network to create an additional category to the Endangered Missing Persons Alert for those with Alzheimer's or dementia, as well as find ways to increase membership in the program. While I've shared my personal story in the beginning, I know that it's not unique and that I'm not alone. I'm sure many of you around this table have similar stories, and I have testifiers here today who'd like to share their stories as well. I should also mention that besides the Alzheimer's Association, we have support from the Association of Minnesota Fire Chiefs, Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, the Minnesota Chapter of Emergency Physicians, as well as the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I have four testifiers with me that will briefly describe why this bill is needed, and I'd like to first kick it off to Josh Ney, who's the Manager of State Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association.
Terrific. Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Mr. Josh Ney, if you can state your name for the record, and please provide us with your testimony, we would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Josh Nye, and I'm the Manager of State Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of HF 28. And thank you to Representative Joaquin for introducing this bill and to the bipartisan co-authors on the committee for your support. Almost two-thirds of those living with Alzheimer's are women. Older Black or African Americans are two times more likely, and older Hispanic or Latinx Americans are 1.5 times more likely to have Alzheimer's or other dementia than older whites. Nationwide, an estimated 11.2% of white Americans and 21.4% of Black or African Americans over the age of 71 have Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. And we estimate there are 99,000 Minnesotans living with Alzheimer's in Minnesota, excuse me. This number is expected to reach 120,000 by 2025. First responders will encounter more people with dementia and their families as this number continues to grow. They will interact while searching for a missing person with dementia, while answering a call about abuse or neglect, even during a perceived routine traffic stop. 6 in 10 people with dementia will wander, and a missing person with Alzheimer's isn't like a missing adult without cognitive impairment. They don't know they need help. They can't explain that they're lost, and they're unable to recognize their own body is telling them to stop. HF 28 will keep Minnesotans with dementia safe by ensuring first responders have the tools, training, and resources needed to help this growing population, especially when they're in crisis. And I ask for your support. Thank you.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Nye. And I apologize for mispronouncing your last name. Your testimony actually conjured up some painful memories for me. My wife's family has had a devastating swath of Alzheimer's that's cut through her father's generation. And we've witnessed some of the instances that you've identified as having been a part of their daily existence. Thank you, Sarah, and hopefully you can stay around a bit for questions. Very well. With that, Professor Joachim, I have Mr. Brian Peters next, and if that's okay, I'll call on Brian Peters, Executive Director of the Minnesota Peace and Police Officers Association. You can come forward, sir, state your name for the record, and provide us with your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Brian Peters. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee for allowing me to tell a brief story. Early in my career, many, many years ago, as a new police officer in the city of Brooklyn Center, I was on patrol one evening, and it was kind of cold, really chilly that night. And I was patrolling in an area that usually sees a lot of activity. Well, this night it was pretty quiet. And I had driven past a gas station and nobody was there except an elderly gentleman at a gas pump. And I drove by, didn't think anything of it, and continued on. About 45 minutes later, I returned to the same gas station and the same man was still at the gas pump. Before, he was outside. It looked like he was ready to pump his gas. And this time he was just sitting in his car with the gas nozzle still in the car. And I thought it was odd. I went in and asked the clerk if there was anything strange with the gentleman still out there. And they had no idea that he was actually out there. So I went up to him and I started talking with him. We had a good conversation. I asked him what he was doing. He said he was getting gas. And I said, sir, do you know how long you've been here? And he said, well, I just got here and I'm getting gas. And I just continued to dialogue with him. I knew that he wasn't suffering any medical issue. And I asked him, did he have any money to pay for the gas or did he pay for the gas? And he said, yeah, I already paid, which I verified that he didn't. And so at this point I was getting concerned, but I didn't know necessarily what I was dealing with. Again, I was a very new officer. And I asked if I could see his driver's license and he gave it to me. And I ended up going into the system and I ran his name. And luckily we had a previous contact and there was a name associated with that contact that ended up to be his daughter. So I was able to finally get a phone number. And by this time it was around three in the morning. I was able to get the daughter's phone number and I called and woke her up and I said, you know, I'm with your father here in Brooklyn Center and they lived in Coon Rapids at the time. And I said, I just explained, you know, kind of my brief encounter with him. And her heart sank. She said, I'm so thankful. We've been trying to get him into an assisted living facility because he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And she said, I'll be right there. And again, as a new police officer, it was something that I had never experienced before, but I just thought to myself, if I didn't take the time to come back and check on him, what would have happened? And, you know, since then, I think all of us have seen so many pictures on the news of help find this individual. You know, the internet has been a great tool to also bring awareness. But I just think that, you know, this is a great bill. We completely support it. I think that any additional training for police officers in this area would be helpful and probably would save a life. So with that, that's my story. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. A good story paints an accurate description of why laws and policies are important. Fortunate for that gentleman that you were there at that point in time, but obviously Joaquim is looking for ways to make sure that whoever responder is going to be there, you know, will approach interactions with good best practices, as you demonstrated. With that, Representative Joaquim, I have two others as well. So let me call them one at a time. Aubrey, and I hope I pronounce this correct, Aubrey Hagen, an Alzheimer's advocate. If you can come forward and identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Aubrey Hagen, and I'm from Duluth, Minnesota. I have been a caregiver for my mother, who suffers from early onset Alzheimer's, for 7 years. Growing up, my mom was my best friend. Every moment we spent together was full of laughter. She loved deeply and endlessly. She was gentle and compassionate, and she lit up our room when she walked in it. Watching this disease dismantle her loving spirit piece by piece has been one of the most devastating things I've ever gone through. Navigating my mother's disease was never easy, as Alzheimer's manifests in many different ways. During her time in a local memory care facility, my mom's dementia began to accelerate into unpredictable and quite shocking behavior. She would react to staff members with sudden anger or at times even violence. And on one such occasion, the staff called 911. My mother was nearly transported in the back of a police car to the hospital until, thankfully, a family member was able to rush to the facility and insist that she be transported by ambulance. The terror and isolation of riding in the back of a police car with two officers she did not know would have been tremendously traumatizing for my mother. When I arrived at the hospital, I was immediately intercepted by a frantic staff member, rushed into a room where I found my mom in a bed, shaking and crying with the two police officers flanking her on either side. I remember how scared she looked and how her arms immediately reached out for me. I'm sure that the responding officers did what they were trained to do when someone is reported to be violent or combative, but my mother was not a normal case. She was suffering from a disease that not many people have the knowledge or education to truly understand. She was disillusioned and frightened, and I was not present to advocate for her. It was apparent to me that these officers did not have the appropriate training to understand the common symptoms of dementia or how to communicate with my mom. I only wish that I had been there to explain to them that my mom is not a violent or dangerous individual. She is a kind, loving person who is suffering at the hands of a brutal, unforgiving disease. That is why the Alzheimer's Association is working to pass House File 28. Having officers who are trained to work with people like my mother would have made a world of difference for her experience that day. I ask, please support House File 28 to ensure that more first responders have access to this critical training and so that they can support people like my mom in the community. Thank you very much for your time and attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Hagen. Yes, if you can stick around a bit, I do see the questions are popping up. We do have one more testifier. And thank you for sharing your story. You know, we do get a lot of sharing in this committee of personal stories of Minnesotans, and I always want to acknowledge the initiative that people like you take to come forward to help us shape good laws that serves everybody, including in this case your loved one. And please know that we work awfully hard to approach that with care and concern and much love. And so blessings to you and to your family.
Thank you so much.
With that, I have Mr. John Bermel, retired Apple Valley police captain. Captain Bermel, if you can come forward and identify yourself for the record and provide us with your testimony, we would appreciate it.
And good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Bermel. I'm here this afternoon in two capacities. One is a retired Apple Valley police captain, and the second as the son of a beautiful woman that Alzheimer's disease devastated. As a public safety professional, I support the law enforcement training proposed in this bill. Recognizing dementia and Alzheimer's will help tailor an officer's approach to an individual and to treat that person with the respect and dignity they deserve. Recognizing signs of dementia and Alzheimer's in drivers will help prompt the necessary steps to help get a person out from behind the wheel when they are suffering from this disease. This is an invaluable service to families who recognize the driving problem, but often feel powerless to intervene. Learning to discern signs of neglect, abuse, and fraud also facilitate critical intervention. I remember a number of cases as a law enforcement professional where a predator got access to a person with dementia or Alzheimer's as a guardian with power of attorney, gaining the ability to make nefarious, devastating decisions about finances and medical treatment, including prescription medications. Making this type of training available to law enforcement, especially agencies without deep resources, is important, and I would even go as far as to say critical. As a family member devastated by watching a loved one decline from Alzheimer's, I support the enhanced alert capabilities. When we were caring for my mom before we got her into a transitional care facility, she left the house one day. I didn't know she left for a walk and hadn't returned. And until you experience that, you don't know the feeling. It's just rock bottom. Thankfully, I had insight into processes and I had personal relationships that allowed us to call local law enforcement. In this case, it was the Lakeville Police Department. We got an effective response from them with personal touch. Officers looked for mom. They found her. They returned her home safely and with dignity. The officer led her out of the car for the last half block to walk home. My mom's a very proud woman. So this is the attitude of service, compassion, and care that I hope the training and provisions in this bill will foster. And because of that, I fully support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Bermel, for your testimony. And also for reminding us of the central importance of the application of not only how we interact with one another in society, but with the expectations that we should have of our public institutions and our public agents to be able to reinforce the dignity of others and to approach our work with much compassion. Much blessings to you and to your loved your beloved mother. And also thank you, Captain Bermel, for also pointing out the need for resources for, as this bill identifies, I believe, Representative Joachim, for the development of tools, training, particularly for agencies that may not have the resource base to be able to provide that. With that, members, we're going to open this up for questions and discussion. We have four members currently seeking recognition. We'll begin with Representative Poston and then followed by Representative Huot. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Joaquim, I just want to say thank you to you for bringing forth this really, really important bill and for asking me to be a co-author on it. Thank you. This is very personal, hits very close to home for me. I lost my father and my mother to dementia. My wife lost her first husband to dementia. So my stepdaughter lost her father to dementia. And we've certainly shared a lot of stories about how this awful disease changes people. My 5'5" tall, 90 pound mother had sundowner syndrome. And if you're not familiar with that, people with sundowner syndrome can get really mean and actually can get kind of physical. And I actually heard her, and I was 55 years old at the time, I actually heard her swear for the first time in my life. You know, and so it does change people. Yeah, I can see where a police officer would really, or a first responder would really have a hard time being able to identify who they're dealing with without this training. So I think it's really, really very, very important. And Chair Mariani, if I could just take a point of personal privilege for just a minute. I don't get to brag about my wife and my stepdaughter very often, but you know, some good comes out of things like this. And in my case, my wife and my stepdaughter have done some really remarkable things. They're certainly Alzheimer's advocates. My daughter has become an author. She writes Alzheimer's books for children. My wife has started this support group in the Brainerd Lakes area for people that have a spouse that has Alzheimer's, helping them through that process. My daughter has spoke at the Meeting of the Minds, which is a yearly or annual meeting, and talked about the effect on children. My wife and my daughter started the Walk to End Alzheimer's in the Brainerd Lakes area, which now brings in about $150,000 a year. Started in 2009 at zero, and today they bring in about $150,000 a year. So I thank you for just let me brag just a little bit, to say the least. I'm very proud of them. And Representative Joaquim, thank you again for bringing this forward. You have all my support. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Huat, and a shout out and honor to your wife and your daughter for their passion and their work.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Huat, and then Representative Johnson. Representative Huat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Joaquim. We've had many discussions about this bill, and I just really think it's a great bill. As you are aware, and Brian Peters is also aware, we get a lot of requests for training to go to officers and first responders. As I get a lot of those bills, because I'm in that arena, and everything from mushroom awareness to how to use a cell phone. This bill really is going to do a lot of help with a lot of our police officers and first responders. It's one of those areas that as an EMT, I probably took a unit on this in school. But I never had a refresher on it, and it really would help. So I really do support this, and thank you so much for bringing this forward. And I think I'm looking forward to seeing the good work that this bill does. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Huat. We have Representative Johnson, then Representative Hollins. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mary. Ani, Representative Joaquim, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I support this bill 100%. But I do have a couple concerns or questions on it. I'm glad you limited these grants and stuff to smaller police departments. 90% of our police departments and sheriff's offices are less than 50 officers. But we have the large ones like Minneapolis, the State Patrol, and St. Paul, and a few other ones. But I'm also concerned because we also, Minneapolis and are involved with two other small departments inside the cities of the first class. That is the Three River Parks District and the Minneapolis Park Police. They're smaller. Plus, we also have three state agencies that are small in numbers as well, which is Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement, Commerce and Fraud Bureau, Department of Corrections. I have a tough time. I want to get these grants to the offices that are actually working in the public, especially with these smaller departments that can't afford the training. I'm glad it covers 90% of them, but I'm just wondering if we should tweak it a little bit to make sure it goes to actual departments that are not state agencies or affiliated with the cities of the first class where they have better funding to do this. But like I say, I'm glad you're bringing this forward, and I would like to see this go straight to the general register now because it's that important. I myself have had family members with those issues, and I know how frustrating it is for the families. But I can also tell you, as an officer, it's frustrating trying to get the information to find out who these people are in order to actually find out where they belong. I've dealt with it myself in my career, and I would say any officer with any experience at all on the road has dealt with this. They know how to deal with it, but it's a little extra training doesn't hurt, and I'm also glad it's not mandated training. It's so the departments have more issues with it can actually get the training they need. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Hollins, and then we do have some amendments that we'll take up. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also am completely in favor of this bill, so maybe this is a pointless exercise at this point, but I just wanted to illustrate a real-world situation where this would come into play. My grandmother suffered from Alzheimer's, and you know, she was a Black woman in the South, and she would cook, and she would frequently leave her house with a knife in her hand. And it wasn't that she was interested in harming anybody or doing anything, you know, nefarious. She was just confused, and she would decide to go for a walk and forget to put down a large kitchen knife. And I think having this additional training is so important, because it is only by the grace of God that she made it out of that situation alive and well. And it happened multiple times. So I'm really thankful that Representative Joaquin brought this forward. I'm really grateful for the Alzheimer's Association working with her on this, because this is so critical and so important for anybody who has a loved one who has suffered from dementia. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. And a good reminder and of several things. One is the many expectations we have of our first responders and peace officers in particular. We did hear this last summer during the police accountability debate, the incredible stresses that that can provide and the need for stresses on the officers and the need for good, strong training in order to interact you know, with the ways that we've heard today, with you know, positive interactions that lead to good conclusions. That that sometimes just happens, but we have the ability to help push it in that way with these kind of proposals. I did see Representative Cleaver raise her hand, so Representative Cleaver.
Thank you. I just need a point of clarification. So with Representative Johnson's comment, and I think either Representative Joaquim or Mr. Nye could answer this question for me. So Three Rivers Park District is in based in the city of Plymouth. We are not a city of the first class, but we do have a police department with the city of over 50 officers. So would Three Rivers Parks be receiving funding under this? Because I look at their park district and it has lots of winding paths that they know best. And I do agree with Representative Johnson that we want to make sure that all of the small departments receive the grants to help with that, with their training. I know Plymouth does a lot of training in this area, but would Three Rivers Parks be covered by this?
Yeah, great question, and thanks for helping the chair not simply blow by an observation that probably did require some interpretation, so I appreciate that. I'm going to turn to Representative Joachim, and Representative Joachim, we also have fiscal and House staff here that might help with that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's $400,000 for 2022 and 2023, and it's not a mandatory training, so agencies can apply to get the grants, and of course, it's not nearly enough money to address all the agencies across the state. In the language on line 1.23, you also see that it gives priority for departments of 45 officers or less, but that doesn't mean if not enough people with 45 officers or less applied, that it wouldn't then go to other agencies. Like I said, this is just a beginning. Hopefully we can look at maybe putting this, I've seen other bills, I think Representative O'Neill had one in the past that then put the appropriation into the base budget, but I didn't think that was feasible this year. So this is just a start.
And I think I do know the answer, but just to be clear, because Representative Cleavorn asked about the Three Rivers jurisdiction, which exists physically within another jurisdiction, another law enforcement jurisdiction, at least geographically. I take it that those entities, including perhaps like the Minneapolis Park Board, would then be eligible for these grants?
Chair Mariani, I kick it over to your nonpartisan staff to answer because I don't want to speak out of turn, but the way I see it drafted saying agencies under 45, that would mean any agency under 45. So
the author's intent is that it would be that. I'm wondering if our House staff, I don't know which one of our members can help us answer that question. Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, I assume since it's a licensed peace officer agency that it would be entitled to apply for the grant, just like the others. And I'm not certain how many officers they have, so I don't know if they would meet that 45 threshold or not, though.
Okay, I think that's very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Yeah. And thank you, Representative Cleveland, for returning us back to that. So members, let's go forward with the amendments. There are two amendments. There's the, actually one amendment. We already did the first one. The A2 amendment, who's authoring that?
That would be myself, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Johnson moves adoption of the A2 amendment. Representative Johnson, to your amendment.
Let me get it up here. When I want it, the computer's not working properly.
That happened to me the other day in Ways and Means, Representative Johnson, and
I have it up here now. The A2 amendment is very simple. Generally, when we have these grants, especially things like this, we have sending out the funding, whether it's OJP or any other one of the divisions that send out grants, we have a certain percentage that we allow for administrative costs. This one does not have one on there, and I want to get as much funding to these grants as possible. So I my amendment allows for 1% of the total amount of the appropriation of that's available to use for administration of costs incurred by the department in carrying out the provisions of this section. I've seen some as high as 5% for administrative costs, but I want to keep it as small as possible because I want to get these officers trained the best they can because Alzheimer's and dementia is a huge issue that we need to deal with.
Very well, thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. It's my understanding I reached out to DPS today when I found out about the amendment, and the OJP already has a standing appropriation for administrative costs at 2.5% within their budget. And they had intended to tap into that to help administer this. And I'm worried that adding this language would actually add another 1% on top of that. So for now, I'd ask members to vote no on this.
Chair Mariani.
Johnson.
Yeah, instead of 2.5% that would come off of this, this would limit it to a 1%, which would get more funds to these officers. I think that I would hope that this committee would look at the importance of this and get as much funding out to the officers to get the training they can use. So I would appreciate the accepting of this amendment.
Further discussion? I see Representative O'Neill is back, rather present. Representative O'Neill, is it to this amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Very well, Representative O'Neill.
I was just going to ask if nonpartisan staff could explain, because there's a conflict between the author and the author of the amendment and the author of the bill, if they could just explain, as I've just come on, like, which is correct? Is it, does it supersede what is customary with OGP with 1%, or does it add it on top?
Fair question. Not sure who that is, perhaps Mr. Waltz?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Waltz, please.
I seem to have lost the amendment on my screen. I just need to get it back here. But if the appropriation specifies a percentage to be used for administration, that would refer to only the portion of money. Only the money in the appropriation would be subject to that and not prior appropriations. Is that the answer the member was looking for?
Senator O'Neill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm understanding Mr. Walls correctly, then it would only be the 1%, not 1% on top of the 2.5%. Is that correct, Mr. Walls?
Mr. Walls. And I think Mr. Walls, this goes to Representative Joaquin's testimony that there's a, I don't know how this works either, but that there's a standing appropriation amount fixed in the OJP grant guidelines, that perhaps universal guidelines. I'm not sure I'm saying that rightly, Representative Joaquin, but
Chair Mariani,
referring to Representative Johnson.
Maybe Katie Knutson can clarify.
Katie Knutson from the Public Safety Administration, are you present?
I am here, Mr. Chair, and I would also offer that Director Weeks is also in on this Zoom hearing, and I, if you would allow, Mr. Chair, I would ask the director to clarify for us what the OJP statute is.
We have all the experts here. It's terrific. Ms. Weeks, please.
Good afternoon, Chair members. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs. Thanks for having me this afternoon. Under the rider language in the public safety bill, each year authorization is given to OJP to use 2.5% of any grant to use towards administration. Typically, throughout state government, that would be 5% for grant administration, and some federal grants do allow for up to 10%. And what this covers is really development of the RFP, and you can see the additional requirements in the legislation to develop this important RFP. But it also goes into launching the RFP process, the grant review process, reaching out to grantees, the amount of work that goes with supporting grantees and getting signed up on the state system, understanding the rules and requirements for receiving the grant and reporting requirements and monitoring. So this money goes a long way in administering the grant and making sure that the money is being used for the purposes that you decide.
Very well. Thank you. It's very helpful. Representative O'Neill, I still see your hand up.
Mr. Chair, if I might. So thank you, Ms. Weeks. I'm just wondering if you could clarify whether or not the Johnson Amendment would add an additional 1% above the 2.5, or would it actually shrink your administration down to 1%? Because that's what we're confused about, and we would like
clarity if you knew that answer. And maybe if you're not sure, maybe Mr. Walls has got that answer.
Ms. Weeks.
Chair members, from my reading of the amendment, it looks like it reduces our ability to use the funding for grant administration to 1%. I don't read it as an addition. So that would limit it to approximately $4,000 a year for grant administration.
Very well. Representative Ali.
Not to the amendment, Chair. It's a general question.
All right, we'll keep you on the list then. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is to Ms. Weeks. I'm not a big fan of unfunded mandates. So I'm thinking about the work that you've just outlined. Is it possible to do that work on only 4,000? It sounds like a lot of work, and additionally changing computer systems or adding requests for proposals, all of that. Could you do that on $4,000?
Ms. Weeks.
Chair members, I think it's a great question. And so what we do is we don't have for grants administration, we really rely on this administrative money, this percentage to pay for our staff. And so our staff is paid for. So if we had a grant manager who has a caseload of different types of grants, we do administer many grants through the Office of Justice Programs. And so that person's time would be used, if they're working on this particular grant, they would use that administrative fund from that grant for what they're doing. The amount of work can depend. A lot of time we see some fluctuation in, if someone is a current grantee of ours, they might not need all of the support. But if someone is new or a new grantee to the state system, there are a lot of rules and requirements that come along with receiving a grant. And we wanna make sure that grantees are successful and meeting the reporting requirements, the financial requirements, and understanding what it means to be a grantee. So that support and time can vary and getting used to the state system in e-grants. So it can vary, but it does take, we take pride in the support that we give our grantees because we wanna make sure that they're successful.
Very well, thank you, Ms. Weeks. It does occur to the chair that, and I don't think anyone was disputing this, that there are costs to actually administering programs. There's people's salaries, there's equipment, you know, et cetera. And so the question becomes, you know, how much of that, you know, should be covered by any particular grant. And that's a fair disagreement, but it is important to establish that cost exists. Representative Joaquin, then Representative Johnson, then we'll move to a decision on the.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Weeks and Ms. Knudsen and Representative Cleburne for pointing out something that's really important. And thank you for clarifying that as well. I think 2.5% compared to other agencies that use 5 or 10% is a small price to pay. My concern is if we cut that down even more, it is only a two-year grant process, and we want to get to smaller departments that may not have had a grant before with officers under 45. And might not know the system and might not know what's even existing. So just being able to have that administrative process to help reach out to folks for the RFP would be very, very important. And 2.5% seems a small price to pay to get this money out the door quickly.
All right, Representative Johnson, then we're gonna move forward. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, as a peace officer and working with multiple different departments, I know that I don't know of a single department that's not in the system for doing grants. They're doing grants all the time. And most counties and most cities have people lined up to help write these grants to make sure they're done properly and that all documentation is in place. What I'm more concerned about is the fact that we need to get the officers that want this training trained so they can do a good job with that. And especially the younger officers who haven't had to deal with this much, those are the ones that really need the training. Older officers have dealt with this situation and they understand it and they're good at dealing with them. As Mr. Peters had said how he dealt with the situation he had, and I've also dealt with them in my career. So I want to get as much money to the program as possible.
And we've had testimony that they actually, on some of the federal grants, they get up 10-15% as well, where they can shift that money around to help. I want to get this money to the officers, to their training. And with that, I do request a roll call.
Very well. Representative Johnson requests a roll call on the A2 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
No.
Vice Chair Frazier?
No.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Edelson? Representative Edelson? Representative Feist?
No.
Representative Grosso?
Yes.
Representative Hollins?
No.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Cleavorne?
No.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Lucero?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Raleigh?
Always yes.
Representative Vang?
No.
Representative Zhang?
No.
Representative Edelson?
No.
That concludes roll call.
Can you give us your count, please?
8 ayes, 11 nays.
Very well. Members, after a good discussion, I really did appreciate this discussion, and a vote of 11 nays and 8 ayes, the motion does not prevail, and the bill is not amended with the A2 amendment. Representative Joachim, final words for us, and I believe actually our motion is to send this to the Ways and Means. I have instructions here to lay over, and I think it's because, in fact, there is a $400,000 a year appropriation, which is an appropriate then issue for the committee to determine. This is just for new members, you know, more than anything else in the public, that it's very unusual for us to send bills out with a cost unless there's already a identified source for that and there's an agreement to move forward with that. Typically, those are special revenue funds. In this case, this would be part of the determination of this finance committee as it puts together its finance budget bill a little bit later in the session. So what we will typically do then is either vote a bill down completely or lay it over so that we then would take it back up at the point at which we are reconstructing our budget bill. And so that I will be laying this over, but Representative Joachim, final words and no doubt encouragement for us on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Raleigh is waving at you.
Representative Raleigh. Oh, I'm sorry. You did want to comment on the bill. I apologize.
I did. No worries. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. To the author of the bill, how are you, and the reason I asked the question, I was so late in raising my hand, is I heard the term RFP and that it's going to go through a process. As the author of the bill, could you give us some guidance on your intent on delivery of this training? Do you see this being in-person training, or do you see this as being an online, like, learning management system or LMS, or how do you see this being delivered? Because going to the amendment and going to the way that this is going to be structured, do you think this could be a centralized training that people could subscribe to, reducing the amount of a per-contact training? Or is this going to be an in-person training that has to be delivered, you know, throughout the entire state, Mr. Chair?
Yes, thank you, Representative Yonke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Raleigh. Actually, right in the bill is how this is going to be, how the OJP can work with the stakeholders. I am not an expert on training, or am I an expert on OJP grants? So I leave it up to the experts on how to deal with these, but maybe Mr. Nye has some additional comments because he's been working on this.
Mr. Nye, 20 seconds, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative Raleigh, I think the answer right now is all of the above. You know, in conversations I've had with police, fire, and emergency responders, they prefer in-person training, which, given the current pandemic, we can't really do. And so I know our colleagues in North Dakota have transferred or have gone from in-person trainings to virtual trainings, which aren't as effective, but they are working. Officers in North Dakota are taking this training. They're interacting with each other. They're asking questions. And that's where we see the growth happening. And so we think it's important that there be options that we, you know, we meet officers where they're at so that somebody in Roseau, for example, can take the same training as someone in Bloomington. And so I hope that answers your question. But I think all of the above is the appropriate response.
And it sounds like a good, wise best practice. Excellent question, Representative Raleigh. Thank you. Representative Joaquin, you have 5 seconds to wrap us up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Mr. Peters, Ms. Hagen, and Mr. Brumell for sharing their stories, especially Ms. Hagen, of reminding us that folks that have Alzheimer's don't always look the same as what we think they will. Members, thank you for the discussion. I think this legislation is a good first step to address the safety of our seniors that we have aging in place all over our communities. This bill has truly been a labor of love for me, and I would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative and Chair Joaquin, and thank you for all the testifiers as well for being with us here today and encouraging and informing us on this bill. The chair will lay over House File 28 as amended and for possible inclusion in our omnibus finance bill. Members, with that, we will now pull up House File 856, Representative Hollins. So Representative Hollins moves to refer House File 856 to the General Register. Is that your motion, Representative?
Yes, it is. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. We also have,
go ahead. That's fine.
We also have included the A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment, to make the bill identical as to how it passed out of committee last year.
Very well. House File 856 being before us, Representative Hollins moves adoption of the A1 amendment, which puts the bill in the shape that the author wishes it to be before us today. If there's no objection to a oral vote, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All same side. Motion prevails, and House File 856, as amended, is before us. Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, fellow committee members. Those of you who were part of this committee last year might remember this language. It was passed by the House before COVID-19 shut down the regular session, and it wasn't able to cross the finish line last year because of COVID-19. But I do think it's a really important bill, and I'm really excited to be carrying it. So it is a bill that will help try to prevent and break the cycle of incarceration for people with traumatic brain injuries, strokes, or fetal alcohol syndrome who find themselves caught in the criminal justice system. And I'd like to take a second to thank Representative Munson and the others who worked on this bill in the past and who carried the bill in the past and the support of the committee last year for this piece of legislation. I have two testifiers with me and they will give brief remarks. I have Jeff Nachbar, who is from the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance, and he will be giving some brief background into the language. And then I would really love the committee to hear from Mr. Tim Berry, who has been fighting this battle for his daughter, Cassie. With that, thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. Mr. Nachbar, if you can come forward and identify yourself for the record and provide us with your testimony, I'd greatly appreciate it. Welcome.
Thank you much, Mr. Chair. Jeff Nachbar with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance. It's nice to see all you guys. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 856 and the work you guys have done on this in the past. I'll just briefly make a couple of points. And as Representative Holland says, really what we're trying to do is to break the cycle in the criminal justice and incarceration system faced by people with brain injury, stroke, and fetal alcohol spectrum disorder that get caught in this system over and over again. This bill asks for neuropsychological examinations to be conducted and considered prior to sentencing in felony cases for people with brain injury, stroke, or fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. It is not a get out of jail free card. It is asking for consideration by the judge prior to sentencing of this examination to take a look at the exact nature of the impairment that this individual is suffering. I just want to say over the course of time, we've been working to balance the cost of these examinations with getting the bang for the buck and to help get the most vulnerable the service and supports that they need. That's why we saw the amendment, and that's the way the bill sort of traveled through the process last year. I can stand by for any questions if you want to get specific about what those changes were and why we made them. But the people who are at the greatest risk of the system are who we're trying to have the biggest impact. And then as you heard, you may recall from last year, this was moving along and we got hit by COVID-19. This is where we got to. So this is where we want to start and continue to move the process. And we'll certainly look for the guidance of the chair and the committee in terms of how to continue to find that great, you know, the right spot where we can make sure they have the biggest impact and have the most ability to make contributions to save this, break people out of this cycle and to save the ongoing costs of continual incarceration. So I'm happy to stand by and answer any questions that that we might have. I'm sure the committee would prefer to hear from Mr. Berry, who, as you may recall from last year, and his story about how this has dramatically affected his family. But I will stand by, and I do thank you for the opportunity from the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance and our community for your consideration in helping us deal with these situations where people don't have the inhibition control functionality or the sense of consequence that they not get so wrapped up in the system we can break that cycle. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you, Ms. Annette Byron. Glad to have you back again this year advocating for this bill and on these issues. With that, Representative Hollins, I believe Mr. Berry is with us. Should I call on him then? Very well.
Yes, please.
Very well. Mr. Berry, welcome back to the committee. It's good to see you again, sir. Please state your name for the record and then give us your testimony.
My name is Tim Berry, and Chair Mariani, members of the committee, I thank you for having me back. I know probably a lot of you know me from last year running around to the Capitol. I want you to know this is my daughter. That is Cassandra. The treatment of the mentally ill in our state in and of itself is a crime. This from a sergeant at the Crow Wing County Jail. The Department of Human Services just slams the door on us from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. Tim, your daughter is a poster child for a broken system. This from a Department of Human Services employee. Commissioner Paul Schnell went to visit my daughter in prison last spring. He came back and he says, Tim, your daughter does not belong in my prison. Representative Jack Considine, who sat on this committee last year, went out and visited my daughter firsthand. He came back and he said, Tim, what is your daughter doing in prison? What's a father to do after hearing things from a system which I thought was designed to protect the vulnerable in our society? These are just a few of the things I have heard over the last 7 years trying to get my daughter Cassie help in our state. My walk from the Clay County Courthouse to the Capitol in April of 2018 accomplished nothing more than to get me 2 pant sizes smaller. That same May, I took 202 letters, hand-signed, hand-delivered to every representative, the senators, and the governor and the attorney general. The response I received, absolutely none. This has led me to this point. Cassie's story, bipolar at 15, which turned into addiction through self-medication. At age 26, she had a massive frontal lobe stroke, a TBI. Along with the amputation of her right leg due to the stroke. Since that time, I have been trying to get Cassie help wherever possible. Basically, the only place she has been is prison and jail and maybe a treatment center that is not designed for stroke rehabilitation. While in prison, she received her prosthetic leg and was beginning to walk. The inmate stole the remote control to her leg and flushed it down the toilet, leaving her leg inoperable. The prison sent her leg to Essentia Health in Fargo to be repaired. Essentia Health repossessed her leg for non-payment because when you're incarcerated, Social Security disability will not cover. My daughter essentially got amputated 2 times. What psychological damage did that do along with the stroke and the TBI? When she is in jail or prison because of her brain injury, the lack of impulse control and sense of consequence, my daughter spends most of her time in solitary confinement. What further damage does that do? Cassie currently sits in Shakopee Women's Prison in solitary confinement. Why? In August of 2018, my daughter went to Tapestry, a dual diagnosis treatment center, which she was there probably 2 weeks. And because of the brain injury, her and her roommate got in an argument over a pillow, and my daughter threatened to kick her roommate with a pillow. Tapestry kicked her out of the treatment center for the exact behavior that she was there to address. She came back to Fergus Falls. Probation parole put out a warrant for her arrest. She called the Fergus Falls Police Department and said, come and get me. She knew she was going to go to jail, so she took a bunch of her medication she has for bipolar. She is on a myriad of medications. She took a bunch of medications. By the time the cops got there, she was out of it. They took her to detox. 2 days later, somebody left the front door open to detox. My daughter, in her wisdom, wheels herself out of detox, down the elevator and out the front door. They caught up with her across the street, wheeling her back in. She struck an orderly. They charged her with assault, felony escape, and put her in the Clay County Jail, where she accrued 2 more assault on staff. And so that is why she's in prison right now. This is but a minuscule part of Cassie's story. This has been going on for 7 years. And I'm sure just one story that could be told by families across the state. I am calling on the Minnesota State Legislature, along with the governor, to address the abuse of the mentally ill in our state. From my perspective, if an individual treated a vulnerable adult or mentally ill person the way the state treats them, they themselves would be put in jail. Time has come for criminal justice and human services reform in our state so people and families can get the help they need and stop the suffering. All I'm asking for with this bill is right here, a neuropsychological exam, which I had to do 3 years ago and pay for it out of my own pocket. $3,500, which was absolutely useless because the judge could not use this in sentencing or anything else. The doctor's opinion, Cassandra does have mental deficiencies from her stroke, but also from her history of seizures, migraine headaches, multiple concussive episodes, polysubstance abuse, and PTSD. Treatment, to the best of my ability to determine, has not been consistently applied to this individual for many reasons, but nonetheless, there are treatments that could attempt to assist Cassandra's develop more control over her life. This would likely be a rehabilitation strategy involving multiple disciplines, including psychiatry, neuropsychology, speech pathology, cognitive rehabilitation, as well as occupational therapy and physical therapy. Restoring her to her use of this prosthetic would also help in the progress. I think treatment for her would be an appropriate avenue to proceed. Cassandra's basically is in experiencing the late effects of a right hemisphere stroke that are superimposed on a pre-existing problems described above. Nonetheless, there are many behaviors that could be amenable to appropriate stroke rehabilitation. Members, I ask for your support. A policy paper in 2016-17 decriminalizing the mental illness, fixing a broken system put out by the Conference of the State Supreme Court Administrators would be an excellent start. When mental illness is a factor in lawlessness and that fact is ignored, the result can be unproductive recycling of the perpetrator through the criminal justice system with dire consequences to us all. That is Chief Justice Judith Kay. Members, I ask for your support. Help save my daughter, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Berry. Some of you who are new to legislature probably are not aware that Tim has been engaged in this advocacy position, both policy, but also on behalf of his daughter for a number of years. He walked by himself in the dead of winter down from up north where you live, sir, and all the way to the state capitol to draw public attention. And in many ways, Mr. Berry has become, I don't believe he set out to, but he has become kind of the everyman layperson advocate and expert advocate for addressing the incredible gaps that we have with treating mental illness, approaching work and mental illness work in our corrections and in our judiciary systems. Members, discussion, and then I do believe there is an amendment as well. Any questions for our testifiers first? Okay, I'm sorry. I had the wrong screen up. Representative Novotny, then Representative O'Neill, Representative Johnson, Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. For Mr. Berry, thank you for coming once again. I know this is a hard situation for you. In light of the COVID situation, is she still in, even with all the releases for medical reasons that were available with COVID?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Berry, yes.
Yes, sir, she is. She's in solitary confinement right now, segregation.
Representative,
follow-up question?
Please.
Thank you, Chair. My understanding is that this happened post-sentencing for her stroke, and this would be a medical condition that occurred. Has there been any appeal to the DOC on a medical situation for a release like that?
I've been working with Commissioner Schnell. And we've tried everything. So, I don't know what to say to that. We've tried everything, but she was released last August. She was released to Tapestry again in August for, like you say, the COVID thing. And she was there probably 2-3 weeks, and because of the brain injury, Tapestry don't cover the brain injury stroke part of it. They cover the mental illness and the addiction. They don't know how to deal with the stroke because of the lack of impulse control and the loss of sense of consequence. My daughter can't control some of her behaviors. So once again, she was taken out of Tapestry and put back in prison, where she sits in solitary confinement now.
Representative Abdi.
Just a very heartbreaking situation, and I wish something could be done to get her out of this loop, endless loop of not getting the treatment that she needs. Thank you.
I agree. Thank you, Representative Devine. I think your question began to scratch at the surface of what I'm afraid is a pretty overly complex and not a very people-centered, finance and policy frames. And so ergo the gap that we have with mental illness and corrections. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the author and then just a quick question for you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll start with you. If that's okay, just where is this bill going? It does have a heavy judiciary component. Did you say it was going to judiciary since this deals with the courts?
Yeah, Representative O'Neill, the motion is to send the bill to the General Register. I've been feeling out this issue of judiciary. If it would go there, it'd probably primarily be for any potential cost issues. We're feeling pretty confident that that's not the case right now. There also may well be some cost issues with the local local entities that would be conducting the PSIs. It's the chair's belief that those are absorbable. Those are local costs that are absorbable. I will continue to explore that and speak with the other body as well as they act on this bill. And if it, so for the record, if we're looking at, state costs or costs that the state should be covering, I will certainly bring, and I'll have you hold me to it. I'll certainly bring it up as we put together our budget, our finance bill. At this point, I think it's incredibly important to have this bill visibly by itself on our general registry, because it goes to the issue of how, in my opinion, we just keep relegating this issue, out of sight and out of mind. So yes, the motion would be to send it. The motion is to send it straight to the general registry.
Mr. Chair.
And then you had a question for the author?
I do, Mr. Chair. If I could speak. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to that point, I mean, we're directing the courts to do certain things, and I would think that would be in the purview of judiciary, regardless of who's going to be paying for the examination or the full mental health examination. So I would just urge you to take another look at that before. I mean, I know you could probably pull it from the general register, but it'd be great to have it at least have a quick look over in judiciary. And the other body has the ability to do this in one committee, so they don't have the concerns we do. But to the author, speaking of what the court does, I'm wondering if you could help me understand, because the court does order Rule 20 assessments already, and how is this different from doing a Rule 20? And can you just remind the committee when Rule 20 assessments are actually ordered by the court compared to your bill here, and how is this different? Thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much for the question, Representative O'Neill. I am going to defer to Mr. Nachbar on this. I believe it is different in the timing that is required for it. I'll defer to Mr. Nachbar on this.
Very well, Mr. Nachbar.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I'm not an expert on Rule 20, so you can't quote, I wouldn't provide any useful information there. Maybe your staff can help with that. But what the intent with this bill is that to do the neuropsychological evaluation, which is a more thorough evaluation of the impairment and the condition, cognitive condition for the person. In the cases where they're about to be sentenced for conviction in a felony. And so it was part of actually the work of this committee last year, where I believe it was here, where we limited it to felony cases to try to get at where we can have impact on those most at risk with the most complex cases. So I don't believe it interacts directly at all with Rule 10, but I would defer to your staff on that one. I can't help with that.
Very well. Representative O'Neill.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is an incredibly important point, because a Rule 20 does look at the vast majority of things in this bill. And I'm not an expert on Rule 20, so maybe our staff can tell us. But if there is something that a Rule 20 doesn't already look at, I'd love to hear that. The Rule 20 is actually earlier in the process. I sadly, we had this discussion a few hours ago out in Wright County with this, everything that happened in Buffalo. So maybe staff could speak to that if we don't have any other experts that are testifying as to the actual court procedures and when a Rule 20 is done compared to when this would be done. And if this is actually capturing something in addition to what a Rule 20 would already be capturing, something that the court would already order actually at when charges are being made, I believe. So if, maybe if we've got Mr. Diebel, if he's on, maybe he could speak to that.
Let's see if that's within the scope of our legal expertise. Let me just say that the chair's opinion is that this is a probation requirement as opposed to a court requirement. I have had conversation with the judiciary chair generally about these kind of bills, and it is not her desire to hear PSI legislation. You're right, Representative O'Neill, the other body, it's all in one committee. And so what we're trying to do is, you know, be very efficient about how we move our bills forward. So there's going to be a bit of a judgment call here, and the potential always exists to send a bill back to a particular committee if it's found later that, in fact, we really need to vet it more. At this point, I'm feeling that, this falls more within our jurisdiction of probation oversight, and so I'm feeling fairly confident about moving it forward. But let me ask if your question is within the I shouldn't put it that way. It's going to make them sound either smart or not smart, but if legal counsel can comment.
Mr. Chair, members, this is Ben Johnson with House Research. I believe I can address that question.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Representative O'Neill, you were asking about Rule 20 evaluations. There are two types of Rule 20 evaluations. There's a Rule 20.01 and Rule 20.02. Those do typically take place at the beginning of any criminal proceeding, although can be started at any point during the proceedings when the defendant, the defense, prosecutor, or the court decide to request it, or there's enough evidence suggesting that they'd be appropriate. A 2001 addresses whether or not the person can rationally consult with their attorney, can understand enough to cooperate and work with that person. The 2002 evaluation is more typically what people think of as not guilty by reason of mental illness or cognitive impairment, which is more similar to the neuropsychological evaluation. However, that 2002 is narrower in scope. The standard for a 2002 defense is the question of whether there's proof that at the time that the person committed the alleged criminal act, the person was laboring under such a defect of reason from a mental disease or defect that the person did not know or understand the nature of the act that they were doing or that it was wrong. A neuropsychological evaluation after a conviction before a sentencing can currently be a basis for a departure from the sentencing guidelines. That's in sentencing guidelines right now as a recognized basis for departure. There's also state Supreme Court case law on that, essentially saying that it's permissible to depart if an offender, because of a mental or physical impairment, lacked the substantial capacity for judgment when the offense was committed. The Supreme Court case law talks about whether or not the impairment is extreme to the point that it deprives the defendant of control over his actions. So very similar standards, but not identical.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering if Mr. Johnson could, because he said they're very similar, but not exactly the same, could he explain what in addition what this bill is in addition to what the Rule 20 assessment would be? And it sounds like the Rule 20 could come at really any point along the juncture with the courts or pre-sentencing.
Yeah, no, thank you, Representative O'Neill. I would note that the bill itself, begins with, the scope of when there's been a conviction of a crime. But Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, the Rule 2002 is really focused on the question of whether when the crime was committed, the person understood what he or she was doing and understood that that action was wrong, not necessarily criminal, but was wrong. A neuropsychological examination that would take place after the fact would be broader in scope and would share information with the court generally about that person's mental capacity and ability. And that does not necessarily go to the question of whether the person knew at the time of the offense that the action they were committing was in fact wrong.
Very well, members, the clock is ticking. I do have members' hands up, and I will call on them. However, I do at this point want to move to the amendment so we can act on that and then be in position to act on the motion before us in terms of moving the bill. There is an A2 amendment. Is anyone going to offer that amendment?
Chair Mariani, I would like to offer the A2 to the A1 amendment.
Very well. Representative Narissa Polston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll let you all, you know, contend on whether that's a compliment or not. That's up to you two. But yeah. Representative Polston moved A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hollins, thank you for bringing this legislation forward. I have just one concern, and we've kind of talked about that just a little bit. I had the same concern last session as I do this session, and that is who is going to pay for these exams. I know that the fiscal note came back zero, but that's because we really pushed the cost out to the counties. And in my particular case, I represent three counties. Two of them are very poor counties and very low population counties. And if they were to have several of these exams, it would be very hard for them. They're already struggling to keep their heads above water. And at $1,800 to $3,500 an exam, you know, if a county like Wadena County had a handful of those, it would create a real financial burden for the county. The amendment adds an undesignated general fund appropriation to district courts to reimburse the cost of these exams when one is ordered. The bill requires a court to order the psych exam if a defendant has history of traumatic brain injury, stroke, or fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. I would really ask Chair and Representative Hollins that this would go to judiciary. I think it should. And again, Chair, you mentioned because there's money attached to it, it probably needs to go down that route, I think is what you said, or should. And I would really like to see you work on how this is going to be paid for, because a lot of little counties out in greater Minnesota, low population, poor counties, are really going to struggle to be able to handle this expense if they have even one or two of these in some counties. So I'd really like you to consider that. I'd like you to consider taking it to judiciary. I hope that's the direction that it goes in. You know, with that, Representative Hollins, Chair Mariani, I will at this time, having said what I've said and I'll hope for these things to happen, I'll withdraw my amendment.
Representative Polston very eloquently argued, and I do appreciate that. I will, assuming this vote continues, it will be my expectation of Representative Hollins and of myself to address any unforeseen expenses that the state is going to be able to cover. I know last year we had similar conversations. There were arguments about the other side, that there are savings in regards to, you know, what, you know, the adjudication would be, spending time in jail. Certainly, Cassandra is suffering an incredible tragedy in her life.
Yes.
And also incurring an incredible cost to both our county and state government. So you have my word that I will certainly work on that. And you're on this committee. I expect you to hold me to that as we move forward with the bill. Members, I want us to, I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, and then we'll take a vote on the bill.
Chair Mariani, members, that's the author as well. This does need to go to judiciary. Just one circumstance here. What happens when in the pretrial Rule 20 hearing, it says the person is capable and understands and can stand trial. But after, during the pre-sentence, you have this, go back and have this testing done, and it comes back as not competent. These are issues that need to be worked out in the Judiciary Committee. I'll leave it at that, because that's something we can't discuss here. I'm really not happy. Yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, just because we're out of time, would you be amenable to me adjusting my amendment or having Representative Hollins, it's not my motion, adjust her motion that we send this to Judiciary? It's fine for us to vet it. Is that okay with you?
I just have one more statement to make and I'll be done.
All right. Let's see if it's okay with Representative Hollins first.
Yes. Yep.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
Last statement I want to make, if there's other issues I'd like to on this bill because I have problems with it, it should be a pretrial. But I'm really frustrated with Commissioner Schnell. He has two opportunities to get the testifier's daughter out. Under Minnesota statute 244.054, it's a mental health issue. There's a process there to do that. And what's even more sickening is under 241.75, I believe he has the authority to have her released right now.
Yep.
Why that hasn't been done years ago, I don't know.
Let's ask that question together. Representative Hollins renews her motion that, or rather, amends her motion that House File, and make sure I got the right number, House File 856 as amended be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Is that your motion, Representative Hollins?
That's correct. Yes, that is my motion.
Very well. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller vote yes.
Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
Aye.
Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Rowley?
Rowley, aye.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
That concludes roll call with 19 ayes.
Very well. Out of all of 19 ayes and zero nays, the motion does pass, and House File 856 as amended is referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Mr. Berry, thank you. Continued blessings to your family and to Cassie. Thank you, Mr. Nakbar. And members, thank you for the good, strong debate and conversation today. Representative Pinto, I see your hand is up very quick.
Yeah, just real quick, Mr. Chair. I had concerns about the comments made about Commissioner Schnell, just to say I feel like we should sort of look into this situation. Sounds like that's going to happen. But in the meantime, I just would want to be really careful about making comments about the commissioner caring about something or not caring. We really want to know what the situation is, and I hope we can do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. I think it's appropriate for the committee to ask questions, and we should ask the questions before we make assertions.
Chair Mariani?
Finding. Representative Poston.
Chair Mariani, Mr. Berry has got his hand up, trying to get your attention.
Mr. Berry.
Chair Mariani, say I wanted to say that Commissioner Schnell has gone above and beyond the call of duty to help my daughter.
Oh,
that man. He has gone above and beyond, and I thank him for it. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Berry. Thank you. Members, with that, the business concludes today. We will convene again tomorrow morning. Everyone have a good evening. This committee stands adjourned.